Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today says that the choices we make about food today are leading to an environmental degradation, human health problems, and cruelty towards our fellow creatures. In his book, The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony, Will Tuttle offers a set of universal principles for all people of conscience from any religious tradition that show how we can move our consciousness forward. He's a Buddhist and former Zen monk, and longtime vegan and composer. Will Tuttle, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Great to be with you here.
Now, you are a composer, and when did you begin composing music?
I started composing music in college, probably about 1973 or so. So it's been quite a few years, yeah.
Well, that music we were hearing before we started talking was one of your compositions.
Right, yeah. I was classically trained and went through, my father played the piano, so I was the oldest child, so I wanted to be like him, and he enjoyed it so much. And then, so I went through the whole training of classical music and boogie-woogie and blues and rock and roll, and I was a church organist, so I have a lot of influences. And then during the Vietnam War era, back in the early 70s, I got kind of rebellious and I thought, I don't want to play other people's music anymore. And this music started just coming through me and people really responded and said that it was very touching and healing and all these kinds of things. So I ended up traveling for quite a few years and giving concerts all over North America and Europe and other places. And really, it went very well, actually, while I was doing that. Yeah.
My guest is Will Tuttle, and he is here telling us about his musical career, but he's also an author, a lecturer, and his book, The World Peace Diet, he calls it Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. Now, you mentioned intuition, and I would think that being a musician helped you cultivate your intuition.
Right. Well, actually, yeah, that's been a big interest of mine since around the same time, because there's sort of this essential mystery of where does something creative come from? And so as a musician, these beautiful melodies and harmonies would come to me. And I also realized that living in our society, most of us are disconnected from our deep inner wisdom, and we're more or less living lives that are dictated to us by our cultural upbringing, and they're really not in our best interest. So right after college, I decided I didn't want to just go into the usual job market, that kind of a thing, and I left home with my brother, and we started just walking on a spiritual pilgrimage, and then I really started meditating a lot, like 8 to 10 hours every day. And I found through meditation that it was possible to connect with an inner peace and an inner guidance system, I guess you would say. And so that went for quite a few years. I ended up living in Buddhist meditation centers, was a Zen monk in Korea, ended up eventually getting a PhD at Berkeley, focusing on educating intuition in adults. That was my focus of my PhD. And the dissertation actually was nominated as the best dissertation at Berkeley that year. So it went really well, and I still feel like it's a very important thing for us as individuals to connect with our inner guidance system.
My guest is Will Tuttle, and he is telling us about using our intuition. And in your book, The World Peace Diet, you say intuitive people, not just people, but dogs, cats, pigs, and other animals, are sensitive to the vibrations of feeling and intention that they perceive in people. And I noticed, you mentioned pilgrimage, and I noticed some of the places that I've gone, for example, Lourdes. I'm not Catholic, but when I went there, the energy of that place was overwhelming. Mm. It would almost bring me to tears. And like I say, I'm not Catholic, but the energy, the vibration of that place, of all the people that have been there throughout the centuries.
Right. Yeah, I think, well, you know, these places have a powerful energy. That's what draws people to them. And I've experienced similar things in places, sometimes in nature. There'll be a powerful place. And I've noticed also that animals seem to be very sensitive to energy. I remember visiting an outdoor museum that had a few pigs sort of in an area. But the area was just nothing but mud. And I had a little bit of grass where I was on the far side. And I just picked up some nice leaves of grass and some other little herbs there. And I just had this thought, gosh, I've got some great green herbs here. And this pig on the far on the other side, he lifted up his head, turned around, and came running over. I've seen those kinds of things happening. And I think, you know, animals do have capacities that we really don't understand fully.
It brings to mind an old college roommate visited me some years ago, and we talked about the fact she just lost her father, had died. So we got ready to go to bed, and normally my little dog slept in bed with me. But that night, he crawled in bed with a stranger as if, you know, I know you're in pain and I want to do what I can to comfort you. And I thought, how sensitive of this little creature to appreciate what this woman was going through and do her part to comfort her.
Right, right. I think we can learn a lot when we slow down and take time to become more sensitive to what's really going on around us and within us. Yeah.
Well, you also say that many cultures recognize that food that is prepared with love and caring attention to detail is more healthful than food that is prepared with indifference or irritation or anger. And you mentioned your Buddhist background, and that's recognized in Buddhism.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something, it's a principle, really, that when you're cooking for other people, in a monastery, for example, you don't want to have novice monks doing the cooking. You want to have experienced people who are very established in their meditation practice, whose minds are at peace and in harmony, because the basic idea is that the food that they're preparing for the whole community who are meditating, that people will be sensitive to that, and it could be disturbing to them if someone is frustrated or angry or upset about something, and that actually is in the food. And I think, you know, mothers in India, this is an ancient tradition, are taught to prepare the food with love, because it's really the love, the prana, or in Sanskrit, or the chi in Chinese, is the energy that really nourishes us, actually perhaps more in some ways than the actual carbohydrates.
And, you know, this is hard to explain to people when they look at the way I eat and they say, what's your system, or what is it that you're avoiding or not avoiding? And it's hard to explain that I choose food that has the highest vibration, that has the most energy that I can obtain. And that's not easy for people to understand. So maybe as you go about, you give lectures and you talk, do you think you're getting through to people about this subject?
Well, I think there are the people that are open to these ideas, I think, are helping to pioneer a way of living that's more sustainable, more healthy, and less violent, really. Because the food system in the United States, and I would say throughout most of the world now, has become so industrialized. There's so many toxic chemicals, and foods are so processed, and then you've got animals being abused for these foods. And so most people would just rather not think at all about the vibration of their foods, because if they did, they wouldn't be able to eat the food they're eating. You know, we just learn, I think, in our society to stay shallow, to not look deeply or feel deeply or care deeply, because if we did, we wouldn't be able to eat the foods that are offered at fast food restaurants or even in most grocery stores. So I think it's one of the things that people are starting to wake up about, is that foods can be prepared with love, they can be grown with love, and we now have a food forest where we live. It's about a couple hours from here. And it's wonderful. We have like 50 fruit and nut trees, lots of herbs and vegetables and so forth. And we, of course, go out in the garden every day and send love to all of our plants. And it's beautiful how they bear fruits and vegetables that we can eat. And I think there's something very profound about growing our food in a loving way, in this way.
Well, and I think children, before we suppress maybe their intuition, know, for example, if they were to see how meat is, doesn't come in plastic, but where it really comes from, I think their reaction is horror. Mm-hmm. Because they they haven't been indoctrinated, if I want to use that word, to feel that it's what's really happening when an animal is killed for their food. And I think children react in a human way.
Right. I think it's unavoidable. If we're going to be eating the flesh of animals, we have to kill them, and no animal wants to be killed. So there's no such thing as humane slaughter. I mean, it's a complete oxymoron. If I'm going to kill another being, and it's really unnecessary, you know, because we understand now very clearly that there are no nutrients that we need to be healthy that we can't get from plants. We don't have to harm any animals, actually. So I think you're right. Children are more sensitive. They're more naturally innocent. And I think when I was a little kid, you know, if I had known what it was, my mother said we're having bacon, I was always the first one to the table because I loved all that fat and salt, you know. But it's kind of got, you know, it's yum, yum, yum. But if she had told me what it was and explained to me the terror and the pain that these animals experience and how they're really hyper-confined and driven really into insanity, very often banging their heads against the bars, you know, terrible distress. And I would have been just really shocked. I didn't know that, and I certainly
because you were making a decision based on the facts that you had, which were practically none.
Yeah, I was just. I mean, as little kids, we really don't make a decision. I didn't have a decision. If I did, I had to eat it. I mean, my father said, you know, it's on the plate. You eat it. You know, it's like it wasn't an option not to eat it. It wasn't a decision. I ate it, but I trusted them. You know, and they were well-meaning. They loved me. They wanted me to get plenty of protein, and you know, so there's nothing. No one to blame about this. It's just that's the way the system works. And I think, you know, if I had known as a little kid what it was, I would have said, Mom, you know, can I have some oatmeal and a banana? But I didn't know what it was. And, when we find out later, by that time, usually it's too late and we just sort of resign ourselves to the narrative, the official cultural narrative that, well, God gave us these animals to eat and they don't have a soul, they taste good. If you don't eat them within 24 hours, you're going to die of a protein deficiency, you know, that kind of thing. So the good news is I think we are waking up out of that obsolete way of thinking.
My guest is Will Tuttle, and he is a vegan, a former Buddhist monk, and an author as well as composer. When you say that you, I think you became a vegetarian like in the mid-70s, and I became a vegetarian in the early 70s myself. But now not everybody sees the world through our eyes. So what do you say to people who say, hey, wait a minute, this is, I can't, you're too far out for me?
Well, I know people are afraid. You know, there's a lot of fear in our society because we don't want to be different, and we have certain foods that we identify with. We have an image that we identify with, and so I understand that it's difficult, really, for many people to question the foods that our parents taught us to eat. It's really a very deep program. Anthropologists understand that the most powerful way any culture transmits its values from generation to generation are through the rituals of that society. And the most central, actually, ritual in any society is the meals. When people sit down and eat food, we're not just eating food, we're eating attitudes, and we're eating a certain way of looking at the world that makes us part of our tribe. And so we're a tribal orientation, essentially. We really don't want to be rejected by anyone, and food is the most intimate way that we connect with each other socially. So when someone comes along and is not eating the food of the tribe, right, not eating meat, dairy products, and eggs, then there's this sort of visceral fear that comes up that this is, and dislike maybe, like, I don't like this person. He's from another tribe. He's not eating our food. So I think what we're realizing, though, fortunately, is that animal agriculture is devastating our planet on every level. You can't argue anything else. I mean, we're cutting down rainforests at 4 acres per second now to grow the soybeans to feed to imprisoned cows and pigs and chickens. The oceans are being devastated. Aquifers. Our health is really harmed by all the saturated fat and cholesterol and acidifying and inflammatory animal proteins. So it's not in our best interest. It's just something that we're essentially compelled into by well-meaning people. And so I just think if someone is wounded, like I was for 22 years, I was eating animal foods. I was wounded and I was hurt and I did it. But the whole idea is to help heal, you know, to help awaken. You know, I was asleep. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's just what happens when we're born into a society where we're forced into this behavior. And the good news is that when we're ready, we can awaken out of it. And so I'm not interested in changing anybody. I think the most important thing, and really the only thing I can do, is change myself and try to make myself as loving and caring and kind and respectful as I can. And that's not just to animals, but to human animals as well. And I think all of us, if we live our lives in this way, we can help make a better world for everyone.
My guest is author, lecturer, and vegan, Will Tuttle. And I'll be back with my guest after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Weekman. I'm Nancy Weekman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm here with my guest, Will Tuttle. He's a vegan, and he's written a book, The World Peace Diet. Well, one thing that I'm conscious of, I don't want to make people feel that I'm a more virtuous human being or that I look down on them, if I want to say that, because I'm a vegetarian and you aren't. I'm hesitant to even mention that I am. Particularly if you're invited over, I don't want the host or hostess to feel like they have to do anything special for me. And I just want to be sensitive to other people's preferences and feelings.
Right.
And how do you – you must run into this, do you?
Yes, I do run into it, although quite honestly, now that I'm sort of a best-selling author on a book that's promoting – a plant-based way of eating and living, I rarely find myself with people who don't know what I eat and how I live. but for, you know, probably at least 20 years before, you know, yes, I would, you know, be in a potluck or, you know, Thanksgiving dinners or whatever it is. And the thing is, for me, I've gone to these places. You know, I've been to farms and slaughterhouses and stockyards. I've seen what the animals endure. And I am absolutely clear that it's utterly horrific and demonic what's going on to these animals, and I want no part of it. And so I'm very clear to anyone that I am never going to ever participate in eating the flesh and secretions of these horribly abused animals. And so I tell them ahead of time and in a loving way, you know, that happy to bring something or you know, make it easier for them. But my mission is to help the animals and help humans to somehow evolve out of this way of eating without in any way being disrespectful, because I understand people, you know, we've all been wounded. And so we're at the place wherever we are. But again, the good news is that love and kindness and respect really, I think, call us to be more inclusive and to include all beings in the sphere of our kindness and concern, and to show that there's another way of eating and living that doesn't require us to harm other beings. This is the great gift. You know, we've all been given this wonderful gift of a body that does not require any animal to suffer to get all the nutrients that we need to be healthy. So if that's the gift we've been given, why would we then harm animals unnecessarily unless we just don't know any better? So the idea is just to help share these ideas in a loving way.
Well, I think, even as a kid, I would eat my vegetables first and the meat would kind of sit there and I'd eventually get around to it because that's what was expected. So for me, I didn't even decide I'm going to be a vegetarian. I just noticed that I quit eating beef, I quit eating pork, I quit eating these things. And it wasn't really a conscious decision on my part. And I remember one day when somebody says, "Oh, well, if that's the way you eat, you're a vegetarian." Oh, yeah, there's a label for people like me. So for me, it was easy. It wasn't a sacrifice. Somebody said, "Well, what do you do for the taste of meat?" And it wouldn't occur to them that, well, I don't miss the taste of meat. But there are people who do, and I understand that. And it must be really hard for them to make this lifestyle change. Do you offer any suggestions for people who say, "Well, yeah, you're right, Will, but it's too hard. I just like the taste of meat."
Well, yes. I mean, there's, I think, essentially, like H.G. Wells said, that our culture is in a race between education and catastrophe. You know, and I think basically it's just about understanding. I mean, something can taste good, but that doesn't mean it's right. I mean, it might be pleasurable to sexually abuse someone, but that doesn't mean I'm going to go around doing it, right? I mean, you know, other beings have rights, and it's not, you know, it doesn't mean my feelings and my tastes and my preferences therefore trumps their interests. You know, it doesn't. So, grilled animal fat may taste good. But in a sense, you know, like from my point of view, after having not eaten these foods for 45 years, if I smell it, it's really quite revolting for me to smell it. But I know when I was a little kid or even up through college, I liked it. It's like anything. It's like we like whatever we're used to. So the good news is that there are many sort of transitional foods now. There's, you know, veggie or vegan burgers and cheese and hot dogs and all kinds of things. But I think the main thing is that plant-based foods really are delicious, and people, I think, know that at a deep level. I mean, I've been eating this way, you know, for so many years, four decades now, and it just gets better and better. The foods are so delicious. Whole grains and legumes and vegetables and fruits are amazingly delicious, and I think human beings in general, a natural taste is for that. So someone can say, "Gosh, you know, I really miss the taste of cigarettes. I love how I love how it is." But, you know, it's violent to our bodies. It's not a good idea. It's a certain type of addiction that's not in our best interest.
My guest is vegan and former Zen monk, Will Tuttle. He has a book, The World Peace Diet: Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony, that's now in its 10th anniversary edition. And people might, listening to you, Will, say, "Well, this is all new. You know, our grandparents lived on a farm and they ate animals." So they might not realize how far back into history this movement goes. In fact, I was tempted to call you a Pythagorean.
Right. Well, yeah, that's true. The word vegetarian is only about 150 years old. Before that, people were called Pythagoreans, because Pythagoras actually way
back. The one we think of as a mathematician.
Right. It's so interesting. Pythagoras, we all know the Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared, you know that. But he also said that as long as we eat animals for food, there will be war. You know, I think that's the Pythagorean theorem we really should have learned in school. The ancient wisdom tradition goes back hundreds of years, thousands of years, not to harm other beings. And when I was a Zen monk in Korea, I was in a Buddhist monastery where we had the people in that monastery had been practicing what we would call vegan living. In other words, no meat or dairy or eggs or wool or silk or leather or fur, no killing animals or even mosquitoes if possible, and insects. And they've been living this way for over 800 years. So this is not just a new hippie idea. This is an ancient wisdom tradition that goes back hundreds of years, thousands of years, actually. People have understood that if we're serious about creating a society of harmony and peace and awareness and justice and equality, then we need to be kind and loving to all living beings, and everyone who has interests.
In fact, you have a quote in your book by Pythagoras, "As long as men massacre animals, they will kill each other. Indeed, he who sows the seeds of murder and pain cannot reap joy and love." So maybe that's what you're saying, that that we should focus on joy and love and bringing more of this into our lives.
Exactly. That's the key, right? Focus on being kind, loving, and respectful in all of our relations. And not only is it better for others, it's actually better for ourselves. I find myself so filled every day with gratitude and joy and happiness and creativity and health, radiant health, abundant health. You know, here I am 66 years old now, and quite honestly, you know, I've been able to stay out of the healthcare system for 50 years. You know, I haven't been to, haven't been to a drugstore to get whatever is in there, Tylenol or an aspirin or a Tums or Rolaids or Viagra or RightGuard or whatever it is. You know, I mean, if we're eating the foods that we're designed for and living our purpose, then our physical body will be much more likely to be in harmony. And I think it's a great gift. As we bless others, we're blessed. That's the basic idea.
Well, you know, Will, there are people out there who say, hey, wait a minute. We human beings are omnivores, Will.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the narrative, right? That's part of the story that we're told, that we can eat anything. But look at cows. Cows, for example, does anyone think a cow is an omnivore? Should cows be eating meat? Well, I think we pretty clearly see no, they're not supposed to be eating meat. But cows are eating huge quantities of meat because scientists discovered a long time ago that if you enrich their feed, not only with grains, which really are hard on their system, but with fish meal and slaughterhouse waste like pigs and chickens and so forth. So cows are eating fish and pigs and chickens all the time to make them fatten up and give more milk and so forth. And they eat it because they're being exploited. And anyone who says they're an omnivore and are eating meat and dairy and eggs is just being exploited. You're being exploited and will end up with a much higher likelihood of liver disease, kidney disease, heart disease, breast, prostate, and colon cancer, dementia, all these diseases that come from eating animal foods. So as we exploit, we get exploited. And these narratives really are harmful, not only to the poor animals and ecosystems and future generations and hungry people and indigenous people who are seeing their forests destroyed, but to us as well.
My guest is Will Tuttle. He is a musician, a composer, a vegan, a former Zen monk, and an author of The World Peace Diet. One thing I enjoy about your book is we mentioned the Greek influence and these Greeks that were vegetarians. And you also go to other cultures. For example, you use an expression that I'm familiar with from Taoism, and that's Wu Wei. And it's not W-A-Y, it's W-U-W-E-I.
Wu Wei is, that's a very profound concept. Wu Wei is acting without acting. In the sense, it's awareness of the source of what I am. And so most of us are acting from the point of view of being a fundamentally separate self, just trying to get what we want in the world. Wu Wei is a way of living where we're in harmony with, and from the Taoist point of view, with the greater order of things. And so our actions are not based on self-centeredness. They're based on what's best for the whole, for what's best for everyone. And the individual, I think, each one of us finds our greatest happiness and fulfillment when we're living a purpose that blesses the larger context within which we're living, our society and the earth. And that's really what Wu Wei is about. It's about awakening out of the prison of being a fundamentally separate self competing with others in the same delusion.
Well, one thing you mention in your book is that we tend to separate consciousness, energy, and matter as being discrete things. And you make the point that consciousness, energy, matter are being recognized as a unity.
That's true. And this is an ancient wisdom that when I have spent thousands of hours in meditation and also studying ancient texts. And the basic idea is that as we purify our consciousness, we can begin to realize that matter and energy and consciousness are not fundamentally separate. And we know this, I think. We know that our mind and our body are connected. When we think certain thoughts, our body responds. So this whole idea that consciousness is separate from matter is really part of animal agriculture. It's part of the delusion in our society. And I think we're really at this point in a very exciting time when we're, I think, more and more awakening out of the illusion of materialism. You know, buying and selling animals by the pound, reducing them to pure matter, not seeing them as conscious. We see cows and pigs and chickens just as beef and wings and pork. And that not only harms them, it harms us. It reduces us to materialists, and we ourselves become just an object. And pretty soon we're selling ourselves on the market, trying to make money, make ourselves into an object. So the whole idea is to see that consciousness and matter are infinitely interconnected. And as we awaken our consciousness, we can create a more harmonious society based on respect.
Well, sometimes people, if the meat, say, is cut up in little squares, it doesn't look like any animal. But I lived in Peru where one of the foods was barbecued beef heart. And people, Americans hearing that would cringe,
right?
Because, oh, it's a heart of an animal and people are eating that. But we do have our own prejudices about what we consider acceptable and not acceptable. There are taboos about food.
Definitely. I've talked to people and I've said, could you give up meat, beef? And they say, no, I love beef. I can never give it up. I say, could you give up eating dog? What do you mean? I would never eat dog. And I've been in Korea and I've talked to people and I've said, could you give up eating dog? No way. Dog is so good. Dog soup, nothing so good. Could you give up eating beef? Beef, I would never eat a cow. That's absolutely barbaric. You know, so it's really all culturally determined, basically.
You say in your book, virtually all of us are omnivores. Our cruelty is invisible and unmentionable, like an enormous family secret. So it sounds like, Will, you want to bring this secret out, make it visible, make it mentionable, so that we can take a look at what we're really doing.
That's very well said. Yeah, that's exactly it. It's not, again, not to blame or shame or criticize anyone. It's just simply to become more mindful, become more conscious, become more aware of the consequences of our actions, to talk about what's actually going on. The Taoists always said to call things by their true names. And I think when we do that, it helps us to awaken and live more wisely on this beautiful and very misunderstood and abundant planet.
Well, on that beautiful thought, I would like to go out with some of your beautiful music, Will. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you so much, Nancy. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
My guest has been Will Tuttle, and he is a composer, author, former Zen monk, and author of The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. When I come back, Reading author and Mediterranean trekker Joel Strati McClure drops by to tell us what adventures he's having since he finished his third book. Reading-based journalist Joel Strati McClure has been writing about his global trekking and hiking adventures since the 1970s. His articles on a variety of subjects have appeared in the International Herald Tribune, Time Magazine, The London Times, and People Magazine. 20 years ago, Joel set out to walk around the Mediterranean Sea. In 2008, he published the first of a trilogy he called The Idiot and the Odyssey. Armed with a copy of Homer's Odyssey, Joel Strati McClure pondered life, divorce, Buddhism, and the art of trekking. He has since written a second and third volume of The Idiot and the Odyssey. Today, I've invited Joel, always the adventurer, to give us an update. Joel Strati McClure, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me again, Nancy. It's always a treat.
Well, you are always off on some adventure. What is your most recent adventure?
I just completed a six-week tour, promotional tour, discussing the trilogy of travel narratives, which I wrote about my 20-year walk around the Mediterranean in New England and in France. And I have just returned to Reading for a major event in my mother's life.
Yeah, well, how did you, is that why you make now your home base Reading? When did you decide you travel? You've lived all and worked all over the world. So if you've lived and worked abroad for years, how did you come to choose Reading now as your home base?
Well, I lived outside the States for 35 years, primarily in France, and returned in 2004 to Los Angeles, where I wrote a column about Hollywood, Tinseltown Spy Witness, for the LA Daily News. In 2009, I left Hollywood, and I thought it would be the right thing for the oldest son to do, to return to Reading, where I went to high school and grew up, and spend time with my mother, who was then 90 years old, and of course, I thought would pass and move to a final address somewhat shortly. Of course, you never know how long it'll be, but she didn't. I've now been in Reading 10 years. She's going to be 100 tomorrow, and here I am.
Well, let's say happy birthday to your mother, and her name is?
Helen Strati.
So happy birthday, Helen. Now, you chose to come back as a good son, to come back and make sure your mother was taken care of in her old age, but your mother doesn't even show any signs. I've seen pictures of your mother. In fact, I've met her, and she doesn't show any signs of losing her sense of humor, and she, I'm sure, is an inspiration to you.
Well, you actually met her 10 years ago when I was first on your show discussing my first book, and she was a spry 90 years old, and you saw her again earlier this year when she's a still somewhat spry 99 years old. She did an actuarial chart on the internet that says she's going to live to 117, yet I'm still renting. I don't know. I made a big mistake. But, you know, I did grow up in Reading. I've got a lot of friends there who I've had for over 60 years. So it's a delightful phase of life. However, not quite what I intended to be doing at this age.
Well, now, I mentioned your mother is fit for her age, but you also keep yourself fit because in addition to all the walking you do, you're also a swimmer.
I swim, I walk, I spin, which is stationary cycling. I do weights. You know, I think we only have one body, and we've got to try to treat it as well as we can to live to at least 117.
Well, because some of the places you go, you need to be physically fit to walk these places, or even you've had adventures that are scary to me. Let me remind listeners that my guest is Joel Strati McClure, and he has written a trilogy of books he calls The Idiot and the Odyssey. He's written three volumes of this, The Idiot and the Odyssey, when he walked around the Mediterranean. Now, when you walk around the Mediterranean, France, Spain, Italy, those are all fairly easy. A lot of Americans go there. But you go places that the rest of us wouldn't dream of going, Joel. Where are some of these?
I have been in North Africa, Lebanon, Israel, to the border of Gaza, the Sinai, Egypt, across Egypt to the Libyan border. And I'm still alive to talk about it. Of course, when you embark on a 12,000-kilometer-long 20-year project, mishaps will occur. I took a bad fall in Morocco. I was encountered thieves in Italy, gypsies who tried to take the gold bracelet off my arm. I was arrested for and accused of being a spy for Israel and Lebanon. But these are all kind of fun and games if you survive them, which I fortunately did, and part of the whole trip. And one of the things that occurs to me when I'm in a slightly dangerous or precarious situation is that it'll make a good story and a good anecdote in the book. So I turn it around and I'm pretty positive. I don't think I ever get very worried or upset.
Yeah, I've noticed that. You don't seem to. You take it in stride, and like you say, it's adventures you can use when you're in your writing.
Yeah, my son and I lost our passports and cash in the Mediterranean Sea, totally his fault, which he will admit today, in Morocco after 9/11. And, of course, two white guys with gray and blonde hair walking in Morocco after 9/11 are pretty much easy to single out. And at that point, everybody was wearing I Heart Osama t-shirt. Mm. And Morocco's always been a big place for recruiting ISIS and Al-Qaeda recruits. So we had to take it a little easy then. And when we lost our passports and money, went to the consulate in Casablanca, and were really treated quite badly by not our own countrymen, but by the Moroccans working at the consulate. So occasionally there are little dips, but we rise again.
My guest is Joel Strati McClure. He is based in Reading, but he travels all over the world creating adventures, and he is a hiker and swimmer, and he has written three books on his adventures walking around the Mediterranean. He calls them The Idiot and The Odyssey. And Joel, you present a lot of Greek mythology in your books. And how did you get so interested in Greek mythology?
Well, when I was a kid, when I was 9 years old, my mother, the one who's turning 100 tomorrow, gave me a book called Myths and Legends Through the Ages, which was about the Greek and Roman myths that we're all familiar with, Jason and the Argonauts and Odysseus going to the wars, the Trojan Wars. And I was fascinated by that, the whole idea of the quest, the voyage, the reward at the end of the rainbow has always intrigued me. And in my second book, I'm given 12 tasks to accomplish by the gods. And I have to climb Mount Olympus. I have to find Zeus's birthplace on Crete. And I just really enjoyed doing all of that and meeting all these people and getting to know the various translations of the Iliad and the Odyssey better. So it's been a real educational experience for me. And, you know, one of the nice things is nobody's done it in this fashion before. So everything I'm doing is new and exciting and very, very, very interesting.
Well,
in fact, one of the things I hoped to accomplish after I started was to become a guide to walkers around the Mediterranean Sea. And I did do that for a while with a friend who had a company in the south of France and Italy. So it's been a very productive adventure besides writing the books and talking about them. We're currently working, or I've got a team of people in Hollywood who are attempting to put together a documentary film series about it, but those things take quite a while to put together.
Now, is your son lives in Hollywood, no?
My son's an actor in Hollywood, and in fact, there's some chatter about in this particular series, he and I would be together talking about the various places I went, he went, and it would be kind of a father-son documentary, which I think would be interesting. We're doing another project about a magazine I published in Paris in the 1970s, and if that comes to fruition, and all these things, as I said, take a great deal of time, and you have to live to be 117 if you want to work in Hollywood. There's some chatter about him playing me in that particular series. He, of course, is now in his 30s, and I'm in my 70s, so he would be playing me when I was in my late 20s.
I think that's completely appropriate.
The only way to go, keep it in the family.
Well, now, how far along? Because this process of making a movie, or in this case, documentary, is a really long, drawn-out process. So how far along are you in this? Is it just at the idea stage, or have you taken some concrete steps?
we've got some traction. It's never very smart to talk about things coming to fruition before you put the money in the bank. But there's interest in both projects, and I'm encouraged because I'm done with the walking aspect of this project. I lost a lot of money on the magazine that I was involved with in Paris in the 70s, and this could be an opportunity to get some of it back.
Well, when you go abroad, of course, you're always trekking, you're having adventures there. But even when you come home to Reading, you don't sit still when you're in Reading. What do you do when you come home besides visit with your mother?
I've got a daily blog called Follow the Idiot, and within that is a thing called Where is the Idiot Today? So for the past 6 years, every day I have had to come up with a photo and a brief anecdote about what I'm doing. Just a month ago, I was in Boston and did a piece about pumpkin power. And I often spend time doing fairly odd things, but they do involve walking, and they are, I think, quite interesting. When I'm in Reading, I do a lot of hiking on these fire-scarred trails that we have after the car fire. And I go to the Y regularly and work out both in the pool and the gym and the spinning room. I really think that it takes, it's part of just staying mentally well to get physical exercise as well as writing and doing other things. So I enjoy it wherever I am. I do something.
Yep. For example, you're an early morning spinner, aren't you?
Well, I'm there at 5 o'clock. I don't know if that's early in Reading. That's considered midday.
Well, or in France, it's late.
No, in France, there's no place to spin or swim at 5 a.m.
Well, you plan to go, have you been back to France?
I was just back last week. I was in southwestern France in Biarritz speaking at a conference and in Paris touting my books. And my daughter still lives in Antibes. So I do go back to France quite regularly. I had not intended to be in Reading for 10 years Now that I am, of course, I can't leave. With all apologies to my mother, I'm going to stay there until she leaves.
Well, you could even go first, but as fit as you are, that's probably unlikely.
Well, I could go first, but I don't want to because it would upset her, and then who knows what would happen to her. I've got to try to stay alive for a while. And Reading is a very enjoyable place, except, of course, for the heat that plagues the entire population for 4 months of the year. It's unbearably hot and not getting any cooler.
But then there are the mountains and the ocean, so you can head off into cooler climes when you come back.
Oh, yeah, it's lovely. I'm only complaining because I find it too hot. But obviously we're past that part of the year, so I won't even think about it for another 6 or 7 months.
Well, we enjoy hearing what you're up to, always the adventurer and off on new adventures. And we want to wish your dear mother, Helen Strati, a happy birthday, happy 100th birthday.
Well, she's ready to keep going for many more years, but I'll definitely convey your good wishes and appreciate them very much. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. And we'll look forward to maybe another book, Joel?
I'm more into the cinematic realm for the time being. You know, it's fun to do the walking, to do the research, to write the book, but it's also nice to have a break for a couple of years and be content with writing blogs about pumpkins.
Well, I'll end with the greeting that is used for the people who trek across Spain to the Cathedral of Santiago de Compostela, the Camino, and they greet each other and say goodbye with Buen Camino. So I'd like to wish you, Joel, Buen camino.
Muchas gracias y vaya con Dios.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you, Nancy.
And now Paradise resident Bill Hartley tells us what happened to him and his business after the campfire of 2018. One of Paradise's most well-known boutique businesses was Joy Lynn's Candies. And today I've invited into the studio Bill Hartley, who was owner of Joy Lynn's Candies. So, Bill Hartley, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Now, I see you're owner of Joy Lynn's Candies, and what happened to you on November 8th, 2018?
That morning, I was driving to work at Joy Lynn's Candies and saw the orange sky north of the candy shop and thought that looked a little strange and wasn't quite aware of what was going on until moments later when I received a call from a friend that said the hospital was on fire. And I knew that that was a rapid spreading fire and that we had better think about not opening for the day. Then as later reports came in, we found that the fire was closing in on the core of the town and it was time to leave and evacuate. So I had called my wife, Pam, she was still at home, and said, we're leaving the shop. And she said, grab the cookbook.
Yeah, because people, when they're faced with that situation, what do you grab?
It's still very emotional and devastating. But there, you grab the things that are important, your computers,
your
our case. We didn't have animals there, but your photos and anything of you, that's a keepsake if you have time. And for us, the cookbook was the treasure that we wanted. And our computers with all, you know, our records.
Well, you say that that among your confectionery concoctions was peanut brittle made with Sierra Nevada pale ale.
Yes, that's a big hit, and we wholesaled that item. And at the time of the fire, we had Sierra Nevada was selling that product as well as 35 other stores. So it was a great product for us, and that's one of the first products that we will bring back when we reopen, hopefully, by December of this year. We had purchased another building that had survived the fire, only a third the size of what we had, but it will get us started again and get us on our feet, and we look forward to seeing those smiley faces coming back through the door.
Well, maybe one of those recipes in the recipe book you salvaged was for the peanut brittle.
Oh, definitely.
My guest is Bill Hartley, and he is owner of Joyland's Candies in Paradise, and he is profiled in Douglas Keister's book, People, Places, and Pieces of Paradise. Well, we wish you all the luck in the world opening your new candy shop, Joyland's Candies.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Phil.
This has been Bill Hartley, and he is telling us his story of the Paradise Fire. He's profiled in Douglas Keister's book, People, Places, and Pieces of Paradise. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank my first guest, vegan Will Tuttle, author of The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony, and also Reading author Joel Strati McClure, author of a trilogy recounting his adventures walking around the Mediterranean.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.